Welcome to the People's Historian Podcast with the Zinn Education Project, coordinated by Teaching for Change and Rethinking Schools. I'm Jesse Hagopian, the co-editor of Rethinking Schools and host of this series on Teach the Black Freedom Struggle. In this episode, educator Jessica Rucker is speaking with Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, veterans Cortland Cox, Jennifer Lawson, and Judy Richardson. They discuss the SNCC Legacy Project and lessons that can be learned from SNCC today. So let's jump in.
Thank you so much, Jesse, and hello to the audience. And I'm so grateful to my guest speakers. But let's just jump right into this thing. We're in dangerous times right now. And I'm going to direct this to our three guest speakers today. You as SNCC veterans were working in areas that were so dangerous that other civil rights organizations feared to even consider taking them on. You were behind what Bob Moses called the cotton curtain. And we want to learn from your experiences and about your analysis and approaches so that we can use them today. And the three of you continue to be active. So this is not only drawing from the 1960s, but on your decades. And I want to underscore decades of organizing and leadership. So throughout the session, like Jesse mentioned earlier, we're going to be sharing links to the SNCC Legacy Project website and other related sites. And we want everyone here to share them too. And as a former teacher, I'm just going to say that's your homework. So let's start with the questions. Judy, where's Judy? All right, I see you. I see you. You're in my line of sight now. I want to start this question off with you. If someone has never heard of SNCC, which would be so understandable, given the textbook erasure of grassroots organizing, how would you describe SNCC in just a few sentences?
Yeah. First of all, just thanks. I want to begin by thanking the Zinn Education Project for inviting us, for all the years of immersing work that you and your team do to expand, you know, the larger human rights struggles. And, you know, as you know, we at SNCC, at the SNCC Legacy Project, continue to value our really long collaboration with you guys. And of course, I always love learning from these sessions when I'm an attendee. So I'm on the other end. This is really surprising. Anyway, okay. I'm going to give you SNCC in 3 minutes. Okay. SNCC was founded in April 1960 by activists from the student sit-in movement, a movement that mushroomed throughout the South after that Greensboro, North Carolina sit-in 1 month before in February 1960. And the movement was grounded in the activism of Black students at HBCUs. These students were then brought together by the legendary strategist and organizer, Ms. Ella Baker, at her alma mater, the HBCU Shaw University in North Carolina. At that first meeting that she called, Ms. Baker cautioned the students to think beyond integration, that the struggle had to be bigger than a hamburger, and that it had to deal with whether people could afford the hamburger. She, Ms. Baker, was SNCC's political mentor, grounding the organization in the concept of building bottom-up grassroots leadership, moving away from demonstrations to effective long-term organizing, not demos, but organizing, not the same. Okay, so SNCC soon became an organization of full-time youth organizers, working in rural areas of Mississippi, Alabama, Southwest Georgia, and Arkansas. And we lived in the communities where we organized. The primary issues, voting rights, basically how do you get Black people registered to vote without getting them killed, and economic justice. SNCC was the driving force behind the continuation of the 1961 Freedom Rides through Diane Nash's leadership, as well as 1964 Mississippi Freedom Summer, which included establishment of free health clinics, freedom schools, and a voting rights campaign that was propelled by the formation of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. And this is the Ms. Hamer cue. Many remember the speech by the MFDP's Ms. Fannie Lou Hamer at the Democratic Party convention that year. I question America. A lot of us on this call know this. SNCC chairs have included Marion Barry and John Lewis. And in 1966, SNCC's Stokely Carmichael and other SNCC organizers had been, including the three of us on this call, had been working with local leaders in Lowndes County, Alabama, to organize an independent Black political party with the Black Panther as its logo. Stokely had just been elected SNCC chairman when he raised the cry for Black power on a Mississippi voting rights march. And that slogan reflected a fundamental concept that had long grounded SNCC's organizing. Didn't just pop up in 1966. Okay, so SNCC was always, and I'll end with this, SNCC was always guided by the concepts Ms. Baker spoke about at a 1964 Mississippi mass meeting for the MFDP. She said, quote, "Even if segregation is gone, we will still have to see that everyone has a job." And she meant everybody, not just Black people. "Even if we can all vote, but if people are still hungry, we will not be free. Singing alone is not enough." She ended, "We need schools and learning." Hattiesburg, 1964, Ms. Baker. All right, take it over.
Listen, I love this. First of all, it looks like you're in your living room. I'm in my living room. And just learning that this movement was bigger than a Big Mac, right? And that we need schools and class is in session right now. So I have my notebook out. I hope other people do too. So I want to swing over to Jennifer Courtland. And Judy, I want you to stay right here with us. But my next question is, why do you all think that the right, and I mean the politically conservative of this nation, why is the right prioritizing an all-out attack on education at this time? Ms. Baker said we need schools. So what's this all about?
Jennifer, you want to start?
No. You can go ahead and start and I'll jump in.
I think it's very clear. I mean, what we find today and what we see today is, you know, what has been happening in this country from the beginning. And the reason you see the all out attack on education is it's part of the larger scheme to frame the narrative, from which decisions are made about this country. So whether it's denial of information in terms of education, whether it's lying such as Stop the Steal, whether it's the view that they're making up about women and their ability to control their own health, whether it's about the LGBTQ communities, it's always about a narrative that says that you have no value and we have value. And therefore we'll begin to take decisions about you from the narratives that we create. So it's really about, you know, who's going to set the agenda. It's not only just about education. That's the way it's manifested. It's really about the big question in this country, who sets the agenda.
And I agree fully with Courtland. And I think it's about defining who's in control, who's going to set the agenda, who's going to have the power. And that's something I think we'll need to talk about as the evening goes on, which is power, and not be afraid of power, and think about routes to empowerment, because the people in charge make up the stories and make up the lies, and that we then become the victims of that, and that's not a place that we want to be. One of the things that I loved is that when I grew up in Alabama, that when they were depriving us of a decent, they tried to deprive us of a decent education, I appreciated that the community stepped forward and created, for example, libraries for us. Our parents worked together to create libraries. I mean, they didn't have the best books in the world, but they had books, and they were teaching us the importance of learning and the importance of doing for ourselves. And so I do think that power and the way in which people are deprived of information and correct information is something that is a key part of keeping people down and subjugated. And so it's really important for us to always rise above that and to teach our children and to learn ourselves how to overcome those problems.
Yeah, this is powerful stuff. I want to stay here with power for a bit. So you all talked a little bit about power, but I want to pull out a little bit more some of the systems and structures that we're specifically against, right? We know right now books are being banned, libraries are being closed. Tell us a little bit more about what systems and structures of power we're up against, and say a little bit more about who right now is controlling these narratives.
You know, a couple of things. I want to go back to 1963 for a minute. And Bob Moses always talks about this example. And Bob Moses, where he was in a courthouse, and I think the judge is Judge Clayton, when they were bringing people down to register to vote, the judge said, "Why are you bringing this ignorant people down here to register to vote?" And Bob and others pointed out to him that you created an educational system. It wasn't just people making statements about, you know, education. It was a educational system based on keeping people as sharecroppers. So education has served as a way of determining how people would be able to be positioned in this country. And so my sense is that education is connected to almost every aspect of life in this country. And the example I just wanted to point out, when the judge pointedly, a federal judge, pointedly saying that people who were ignorant should not vote. And therefore, and they should be maintaining a position of subservience in the cotton fields and never rise to anything. So, I mean, I think we have to understand the connection between education and all the other aspects, and it doesn't exist in isolation.
Do Jennifer or Judy want to add anything? Go for it, Judy.
Yeah, just a quick thing, because certainly it's focused on Black kids, but what we're also seeing is that the white supremacists that are in control now, in many of these states, also don't want white children to understand. And it's kind of like what was happening when I was teaching at Brown. You know, these were kids who said, "I'm coming from the creme de la creme of schools." And they said, "How come we didn't know this?" So it's not that Black kids are being oppressed. White supremacists want to make sure that their kids and their kids' kids do not learn about the reason that white people are on top. Because the whole premise of white supremacy is that you're better. Well, if you learn about redlining and you learn about this and you learn about all the structural suppressions that have been put in place since we got here, then it's not just that, oh, my grandfather, you know, came over here from Italy, he couldn't speak English. And, you know, in 5 years, he worked hard, which is not what we do, right? He worked hard enough that he was able to get the money for his store. Everything that they say is with the idea that the reason they're on top is because they're better. Once you give them the information that it's the structural stuff that prevents Black and Brown and a lot of other people from getting equity, then that doesn't work anymore. And the whole construction of white supremacy falls apart. They don't want their kids to know.
Yeah, and what I'm hearing from you all is this idea that when we have systems and structures that seek to limit what people can learn, right? That's one of the ways that white supremacy, I would even advance anti-Blackness, maintains itself. But what I'm also hearing is that education isn't limited to what we do through institutions like schools and libraries, right? Those are the social institutions that are set up. But what I'm also hearing as somebody who's not in the classroom anymore as a public teacher, that it's still my role and my responsibility to be an educator. And so that's why this class tonight is very, very important. I want to talk a little bit more now, this time, about how we gain control and seize power to get to where we want to be, to control that narrative. Because this is something I love about SNCC. We don't just talk about the issues, but we are thinking through and putting into action the solutions to gain control and to seize power. So let's talk a little bit about what SNCC did.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at it.
It is doing, sorry, I don't want to just talk in past tense.
No, I think basically the way we approach things is as an issue of problem solving. It may seem strange to talk about it that way, but there were problems ahead of us that we had to solve, and we had to use the various instruments that we had, as limited as they were, in order to solve the problem. And I think that's the same thing that we have today. We have a problem in front of us. How do we be to begin to solve it? And I think, Jessica, you just mentioned something that I think as we begin to think about education today and solving the problem, we may want to start outside the schools in terms of churches, in terms of community organization, in terms of building a sense of humanity, because what's very critical in terms of people becoming active and becoming serious is that they see themselves as worthy. They see themselves as actors. They see themselves as people who can make a difference and should make a difference. So as we begin to think about, you know, what it is we're going to be doing, you know, we should be thinking not only in terms of classrooms, as you mentioned, but we have the SNCC Legacy Project Digital Movement Platform. People may want to do freedom schools in churches. People may want to just connect one-on-one. But I think that, and not to be overwhelmed by things, let's just look at it as a problem to be solved and steps that we can take to deal with it.
And that aspect of looking at it as a problem to be solved can be so, so very empowering for people of all ages, for kids as well as for adults in a community. And that it's one of the questions that we sometimes get when we're speaking like this is, well, weren't you all afraid? How did you get involved? Why would you do something like that when you were a young person? And we had problems. We were facing problems in our communities that we didn't want to live with. We didn't want to grow up in a society that was framed the way it was. And so that's what led us then to action. And I think the whole idea of thinking, working with others to solve a problem, working with people who have that in common, you began to develop and began to understand the values that you have in common as well. And that helps to create a bond among you and among us that can then propel us forward.
Yeah, this is great. I'm thinking a lot right now about my 7-year-old niece, Nalani, and just the gift of freedom schools and this idea that we are disrupting the false, pernicious, and violent belief that we're not worthy, or that our worth is contingent upon the labor we produce for this country. And so this concept of the Freedom School as being a collective space for liberatory education is really powerful. And it's my understanding from what I've studied real briefly that SNCC really taught history that was denied to us in structural and systemic ways, but that we still found ways as individuals and as collectives within a broader community to say, yeah, but you're gonna learn today, Jessica. You know, this you need to know this truth. And then can somebody say a little bit? I think there was a primer of some sorts yay, come on through. Just give us a commercial version of it, like the 30-second snapshot, because I want folks to see this. And some folks in school might want copies of this as well.
Yeah, I mean, SNCC was always about education. I mean, we understood that we had to flip it. You know, I mean, they were still in the South, they were still learning and may still be learning about the Civil War as the War of Northern Aggression, you know. So we always wanted them in freedom schools, for example, take the state constitution. Okay, does this work for you guys, you know, for those of you and your communities? Does it work for even poor white people? How would you change this? How would you change the wording so it worked for you? You know, it's always thinking beyond what is to what could be and what should be. So we did a lot of publications as well. So it was the Freedom Schools, it was a residential Freedom School, a lot of materials. But one of them was the book that you're talking about. And it was done by one of the volunteers, Frank Chichorka. he did illustrations. But the great thing is that the intro was done by Charlie Cobb, a SNCC, wonderful SNCC person who's written a lot. And that's, oh, goody, you have it up already. Yes, it's about us. It's a history book about us. Ask, so all of this is part of this. And then it has, you know, SANK from, you know, Toussaint Louverture. It has Harriet Tubman. It has the kind of folks that you were not getting generally, unless you were somebody like a Harriet Moore, you know, in Mims, Florida, and teaching this material from books hidden under the desk in your classroom. So we did it. And then we were using, I started doing distribution for it. And you know, the SCLC, Dr. King's organization, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, SCLC, their organization was also interested in using the book for their citizenship schools. So we were sending it up north to the Northern Freedom Schools. So part of it was just, how do you get this distributed once you've done it?
That's right. Wow. First of all, yes, shout outs to Eileen on the chat. These resources are there. Please take advantage of them. And I love that SNCC has so many nimble approaches to ensuring that we owned and controlled the narrative. So now I want to pivot just a little bit to talk about something that was referenced earlier, which is the SNCC Digital Gateway site and my students' own responses to it. So with the primer that we just saw, like for folks thinking about, okay, how can I translate this now? One of the things that some of my colleagues, I was in the electives department at the high school where I used to teach, is we would create zines with students. So we would use powerful imagery combined with language to help challenge these ideas of power and who had power. And so one of the resources that we often consulted when teaching students about liberation, challenging power, democracy and justice for all, and even the concept of the Freedom School was the SNCC Digital Gateway website. So what I loved about this as a humanities teacher, as a special education teacher, is that the site is accessible. There is text, there's audio, and there's visual information. And my students love, love, love that they got to experience historical figures. These are not characters. These are real people who dealt with real issues and made real change, but that they got to deal with historical figures in their own voice through personal bios, interactive timelines, interactive maps, primary source documents, included voice recordings and pictures. And something that really surprised my students when they got to the sections with the people and the bios, they were like, but Miss Rucker, the little line after the dash, It's nothing behind. There's no other year behind it. And they were like, so folks are still alive? And I'm like, yes. So that means, wait, they were younger when they were doing this? I was like, yes, they were just like you, right? Just like us. And so I think this is another thing that they loved about our lessons about SNCC Freedom Schools, is that we were teaching freedom rights, and Black liberation, and that it was intergenerational, and that often there were youth who inspired adults like me to say, well, hold up, if you walking out, I need to too. So next round of questions, that's enough of my narrative. I'm curious, and Courtney, why don't you start us off? How does the leadership of women, this is ironic, all right, anybody can start, but how does the leadership of women advance the work that was and still is necessary, both during the civil rights movement, but also today?
Yeah,
A little spoiler alert. It's okay if you reference this piece too.
Yeah, well, I'm gonna let Judy speak to a labor of love. But I wanna emphasize something that you just said. We were barely out of high school when we started on this journey of education. Most people in SNCC were between the ages of 17 and 22. When Bob Moses, who was 28 years old, was involved, we thought of him as an old man. We thought that you'd never get beyond 30. So let people understand that the primer that Judy just showed you, we were 17 to 22. And, you know, we did the Freedom Schools, we in that same area. I think as you look at it in terms of women in the movement, I mean, I told Judy and Jennifer, I just wanted to mention one person in particular who was one of my favorite people, Ruby Doris Robinson. She was a person that ran the organization. And she, you know, but she was one of my favorites, and she liked me and I liked her, and she controlled the money. And so therefore I liked her even more. But I mean, so I'll let Judy go on and talk about the hands on freedom plow.
Well, I'll tell you, I just want to pick up because when Cortland said, you know, people talk about, when we were talking about this among the three of us, one of the things, Cortland, that you said was, you know, people talk about Foreman, Jim Foreman, who was our executive director running the organization. But in those early days, it was Ruby who ran that organization. So I would like you to pick up on that.
Yeah, I want to, the thing I liked about Ruby, she was both an inside person and an outside person. She ran the organization. She kept the books. She dealt with personnel. She dealt with all the administrative stuff that people did not want to deal with. But in the that was in, say, in the morning. But in the afternoon, she would go on a demonstration and confront the cops. You know, and if you wanted to be on a line with somebody who will go down with you, Ruby was there. So she was both an inside person and an outside person. And so basically she embodied, you know, the ethic of what the students were at that particular time, especially in dealing with public accommodations and issues like that. But she was a tough person who could run the organization in a way that was both efficient and also very personal, in the sense that she knew the people. She knew the people who worked in Alabama. She knew the people who worked in Mississippi. She knew all the staff. So, and she knew them in terms of their idiosyncrasies and so forth. And, you know, unfortunately, she had an untimely death in terms of, you know, some health issues. But in terms of holding the organization together in the early days, it was her. She was both inside and outside.
And I would just mention, just picking up on something, and not to just talk about Ruby, but Ruby was so important. I mean, when you mentioned Hands on the Freedom Plow, for example, a lot of us talk about Ruby Doris Robinson. I don't get to SNCC until, because I'm doing some work on the campus that where I am, and at Swarthmore campus, Swarthmore College in Pennsylvania. And it's my first year, and then I'm doing demonstrations in Cambridge, Maryland, and a SNCC person comes back who had been away and working in Southwest Georgia, Penny Patch, and she says, well, I hear you've been getting in jail, you know, why don't you take off the next semester of your sophomore year, the first semester of the sophomore year, and, you know, I'm on full four-year scholarship. It's like, oh, I don't think so, but we worked it out, and the main thing about this is that Penny Patch says, but since you're coming from the North, you have to do an application to go on staff. And she says, and in order to do that, quote, you got to go by Ruby Doris. Ruby Doris ran that place. Ivanhoe Donaldson, who was a close friend of mine, right? Legendary SNCC organizer. Ivanhoe said when he went in jail, he got a letter from Ruby Doris every day. People had a connection because they knew she walked the walk. She had done 30 days jail, no bail. You know, it's in Rock Hill, yeah. South Carolina. She had done all that time, over 30 days in Parchman Prison on freedom rides. So when people talk about, well, you know, did women have to take low? No, we had Miss Baker. We had Ruby Doris. We had Diane Nash. We had all these people, women whom the men in the organization saw as leaders. You know, that it was amazing.
It truly was, and I was, when I was 17 and in college at Tuskegee, then when we were started our student demonstrations because we had problems at Tuskegee, and it was a wonderful little bubble of a place, but if you went beyond the campus, then you found the same kind of racism that you'd find anywhere else in Alabama, Georgia, Mississippi, and other parts of the country. So we as students wanted to protest, we wanted to march, we wanted to make a change there. And that when I then met SNCC people for the first time who were coming through on their way to Selma generally, it was astonishing to me how impressive the women were. I was impressed with everybody because you had these young men too, who were really making change and who were in their 20s. We were all kids, but we kept feeling that, oh, there's a problem. We can come up with a solution. We can work on this. And that every one of the women that I met during that time was so impressive to me. that I then felt, this is an organization that I would definitely want to be a part of. And it just kept getting better, because then SNCC is also an organization that believes very deeply in working from the bottom up and from the inside out. And that when we would go to communities, like when we were working in Macon County, Alabama, or Wilcox County, Alabama, notice I say county because we were working in cities, we were working in rural areas for the most part. And the women, the people that I met there, very impressive. In Lowndes County, in Fannie Lou Hamer, so many people know her name, but then you had other people like Unita Blackwell, who then became the mayor of her town in Mississippi. There were all of these incredible, impressive women. And the book that Judy mentioned, Hands on the Freedom Plow, provides profiles of some of those very impressive women. Over 52 of them are profiled in the book there.
This is amazing.
I'm sorry, just to say profile, but in the sense that it is their own words, their own testimonies. Some we did recordings with, like Annie Pearl Avery, honey, legendary. Used to carry stuff with her, and we had to say, look, you got to leave that revolver on before you get on the line. But those women, if they didn't want to sit down and take the time to write their own stories, then we would do tapes with them. We would transcribe it, let them see it, and put it in. There are just lots of women whose own stories are in this book, 55, and including Dr. Bernice Johnson Reagan. Yeah.
Oh, thank you all so much. I love how you all are dropping gems and dropping names. So my notebook, again, just continues to fill up. I love it. Judy, you were talking a little bit about the 55 stories that are featured in here. And you mentioned a little bit about Miss Annie Pearl Avery. I'm wondering if you would be willing to share a little bit about who she was, because I'm really inspired by her, because she said, I ain't come off no college campus. Right, really challenging this idea of the education that Courtland was talking about. I don't need to be formally educated to know that I can fight for freedom rights.
Yeah, yes. And also to feel it was an organization where you could feel valued, where you realize you could make a contribution regardless. I mean, I'm coming from the North. I don't know nothing. Okay. I felt absolutely amazed that people were accepting me. And said, oh, she can type. Okay, I can do this. You know, with Annie Pearl Avery, she knew all these things. I mean, she knew the rhythms of the South. I didn't know that. So I'm learning as I come in. And what was amazing about SNCC is that we understood what people could bring to the organization, what skills, what understandings they had, what experiences they had that could be useful to, you know, to the work. And so for me, I was in jail with Annie Pearl. And what was amazing to me, yeah, we had just gotten arrested, you know, and I'm in there, and it was one of the few times. Now, see, the thing is, I don't want to start a story because I know we got to go and break. So I'm not going to, but you will find that story. Oh, this is like an ad. Okay.
I'm you will that find story that story. Out.
And that's why hands on the freedom plow. Okay.
And Annie Pearl Avery is alive and well, and still as feisty as ever.
I love it. But not to cut you off, one of the reasons why what you're saying about just the knowledge and the skills that she brought specifically about the South, why that's so important, is because folks, like I was born and raised here in DC, and I had teacher colleagues who weren't born and raised here. But what I love is that when we can collaborate around shared values and shared goals, I can help share some of the history and context, as long as we know that we're keeping our eyes on the proverbial prize, so to speak. I had some other questions.
Can I quickly ask what SNCC Digital Gateway resource we should be paying attention to?
I would say that in that little moment that we have, I would say plunge into the site. I think you will find the SNCC Digital Gateway really well organized. And depending on how you want to cut it, you can get to the topics and get to information from so many different pathways. For example, we were just talking about Annie Pearl Avery. You can go to People and look up a person. If you've heard of Stokely Carmichael or somebody you want, you can go to People. If you want to know what happened in 1964, You can go to the timeline and it's all laid out there in front of you. If you want to know, gee, when did this start? The timeline can take you all the way back to the beginning, all the way back into the 40s, to the groups and people that were predecessors of SNCC. So there are so many ways that you can plunge into that. If you want to know, how is this relevant to today and today's young people? There's a section on today where you hear the voices of young people who meet with us regularly to talk about what they are doing now.
There also is a search engine that you can just type the name Annie Pearl Avery in, and everything on the across this platform will come up. So there's a search engine.
And what's great is that there are all these primary sources. So what's fascinating to me is I'll go on the site and I'll see, oh, a leaflet from 1963 of Charlie Cobb going to so-and-so, or footage. There are a couple, like the women in SNCC, there's a videotape of pieces of folks' interviews talking about how they got into SNCC and what it felt like at being a woman in SNCC. It's lots of primary stuff, which is amazing.
And what I loved about it as a classroom teacher is that the sources are credible and reliable. Like, I know sometimes one of my biggest challenges was finding like a central repository. Well, I couldn't find one, but that's what SNCC Digital Gateway was. And so from DC, DC's mayor for life, Marion Barry, students were like, what? Our mayor was a part of SNCC? Wait, Eleanor Holmes Norton was a part of SNCC? And so, right, like Jennifer said, and like Cortland and Judy has said, it's just such a multifaceted, accessible space. And not just for student learners, but for me, when I needed to do some background research before introducing students to content, I would watch the videos. And I love engaging with movement leaders of today, being in conversation with SNCC veterans. It's just an all-out rich resource. So no matter how old you are, there's a piece of history reflected on the site that you will be able to connect with. That's what I found, which I really love. But I want to kick it back over to Cortland and Jennifer. We have questions about how do you stay strong in the face of real threats to your safety? Like, how did you and how do you maintain your faith?
And for me, it's community. It is community, and it's that when we worked, when Cortland and I worked in Lowndes County, I always felt protected because the people around us, the people with whom we were working, who were sharecroppers, some were landowners, but many were sharecroppers, that they then had our backs. They fed us. They wanted to make sure we had gas for our cars. They wanted to make sure that we were safe because they felt that we were there to help and to work with them. And that always, and they also would sort of make us know that, don't worry, if that truck comes down this way, we have our guns too, that you are protected. So it was a circumstance where I felt that the community was that protective shield for us during those times.
So I've been on this journey, I guess, 64 years, and probably most people on this call are not 64. And what is interesting, what I keep in my head is, I guess three things keep going in my head. And there's a line from Ella's song that Bernice Johnson Reagan wrote about Miss Baker. And it says, we who believe in freedom cannot rest until it comes. And what's important in keeping people going all this time is a belief system. It's intangible, but it's a belief system. Just as people want to believe in democracy or people want to believe in this or that, my sense is that people should be able to have freedom to reach their highest levels and their best lives. So that to me has kept me going for some 64 years. I think also, you know, what is important in terms of keeping you going is the part that Jennifer just talked about, that you have to be embedded. You have to, even if you're not living in that place, in Mississippi, I'm no longer there, or Alabama, or all these other places, the sense of who I connect to is really important. And here's interesting, one example. So Jennifer and I mentioned we worked in Lowndes County, Alabama. And when I wanted to inspire, and we worked to create a document to inspire, you know, the people in Lowndes County, we used the language and the concepts and the thinking of people we worked with in Mississippi, because we knew that if we were going to talk to the people in Alabama, they were in the same condition, and we had to use the spirit of that community to transfer it to other communities. So my sense is that, one, you know, having a fundamental belief system about freedom, and secondly, grounding yourself in the communities that you think are you trying to work with.
I think another aspect of that is determination and focus, and being really sort of clear about here's what I'm trying to do. And that even though obstacles may come in my way, I'm going to stay focused on that. And that's where, again, some of the songs of the movement played such an important role. I mean, you've probably heard the stories of how when we were in jail, that oftentimes one of the ways that we would sort of comfort ourselves and feel connected was because we could hear each other singing from one part of a building to another. But the song Eyes on the Prize, for example, is another that for me, that's like a little motto. It's like a guidepost that when things are going wrong or bad, and that doesn't necessarily mean in the movement part of my life, that could be in other parts of my life as well. It's about keeping that determination and staying focused, or keeping my eyes on the prize.
Let me just say one thing about determination. People always kept saying, you know, you guys were in there facing all that violence and so forth. You guys were pretty brave. I said, we weren't brave. We were determined. At the end of the day, when you look at what happened, if you go to listen, look at and read the Watts reports, where people day after day after day after day engage in trying to get to where they need to be, determination was the most important factor, not bravery.
Go ahead, Judy. Don't even raise your hand. Just unmute.
Unmute.
Trying to unmute. Here we go. Okay, thank you. And all of that is really, really important. But you got to find somebody else besides yourself that you can talk to, that you can relate to. This is too hard. I'm looking at this chat. Honey, teachers are getting jammed right and left, right? I mean, and somebody who says they just got off a call with a teacher who just this evening gets somebody saying, you got to come into the office because a teacher, and it only takes one, has called you off up because you taught something. You got to find somebody that can be part of your strength. It may be a fellow teacher. It may or may not be a principal or an assistant. It's got to be somebody who can work with you, who can help fortify you, because it's too hard, you know? And so, yeah, you got to be determined. You got to, but you can't do it by yourself because it's hard. So what's carried me through is all these people that you see and the people you don't see and work, you know, I look at teachers. I mean, every time I get on one of these sessions, it absolutely amazes me. Teachers blow me away because they're going into the classroom every day. And that's what's amazing. And changing the world, right? It's, yeah, we did it in the movement, but you all are changing the world.
Yeah, the movement is still moving, you know, through us and through folks in the classroom. And I love this beautiful visual that we lift every voice when we sing. And our song is a freedom song, right? My mind stayed on freedom. Mm-hmm. This is a part of the song too, right? This is a little part of the rhythm and the melody, what we're doing here together. And I love this idea that having a belief system, not just a wondering, but a deep knowledge that freedom gonna come, right? That the freedom dreaming is so radical and that we do it together. And so one of the other things I really wanna drive home is whether it's the butcher or the beautician, whether it's the doctor, whether it's the lawyer, you know, whether it's the principal or the teacher, not to create binaries or hierarchies, but to say that we are all responsible for this work of freedom and providing that protective shield that Jennifer talked about. So I want to ask just a couple more questions, and then I want to take some from the chat because there've been some really great ones. You all were starting to say this, but if you could make it super concrete, because I'm going to be taking my notes too. What recommendations do you have for teachers today?
I think, first of all, the sense of realizing that there is an issue and there is a problem, okay? And understanding that even as bad as this problem is, that problems have been worse than what they even see today. I know when it's happening to you, that's hard to believe. But in fact, there is a sense, I mean, having the perspective that we've had, you know, the situation was much worse, and the determination to make a difference is the real issue. Now, I think, you know, for teachers who are in these schools or in Florida or in Texas, that may not be the place to make the fight, right? About, you know, I mean, you have to determine how you want to navigate that. But as Judy said, you know, having other people who are like-minded, who you can sit down with and say, here's the problem. We may not be able to solve it now, but what are your ideas? What do you think? How can we act in concert in order to make a difference? So I think the first thing I would begin to do is begin to look for like-minded teachers and like-minded educators and like-minded preachers and like-minded butchers and like-minded all these people, and is try to get as many like minds as you can, because at the end of the day, you want to have more people moving with you than they have with them. So that, you know, because at the end of the day, I don't care what the governor of Florida thinks, as long as not the governor of Florida. So at the end of the day, how do we now begin to create a collective effort that is both communal, both educational, supportive, but at the end of the day, political, which says we want people in these offices that will advance where we want to go. So my sense is that the first thing I would do is picking up on what Judy said, we're the like-minded people. How can we talk to each other? It may take, you know, and it's not going to be immediate. It's not going to be next 6 months or 8 months or 10. You know, it's going to be, it may take a year, it may take 2 years, but having the sense of like-minded people moving in the same direction is the most important first step.
And I think that this forum right here is one of those, is a part of that. I mean, the fact that you can identify other people across the country through this Zen education program that help you then know who else is experiencing this problem. That then begins to create more of this community that I was talking about, and you begin to identify more allies, more people who are in a similar place to the place you're in and who can then offer support.
Yeah, that's right. Like these Teaching for Black Lives study groups, these monthly People's Historian Online sessions are great places to build relationships with folks I like to call curriculum comrades, because we're vibrating on a similar political wavelength. Let's do this. I want to ask a really practical question, building on kind of this idea of the intellectual tradition and strategy. I want you all to connect for us how you challenged unjust laws and what you think should be done today about teachers being told to remove books from their classroom or to lock their school library.
Well, you know, one of the things I tell people, and I know it sounds strange, is that, you know, if you, this, what we're seeing today in the classroom is not an issue of education solely. It's a political issue. People are trying to reinforce a concept and a narrative on you So, I mean, we're not like arguing, educators arguing this is the best way to teach, what to teach and so forth. They are trying to establish a political view of the world on you. And I think you have to determine, that's why I said that, and it may be a long-term, longer-term issue than people want to understand, is that the thing that we have to do at the end of the day is make sure that these people who hold views that are inimical to our own interests never hold political office or never be in a position to hurt us. And I think that the organizing has to be almost bigger than just the particular classroom that you're in, if you're going to succeed.
Before we jump to a question from the audience, do Judy or Jennifer also want to respond to that one?
I just would echo what Cortland is saying and say that I think that you shouldn't feel that as teachers that this burden falls on your shoulders to make the change, because this is community. This affects all of us. It affects all of our children, it affects all of us, and that the community needs to be a serious part of stepping forward to protect the teachers and to protect education in this country.
I would also mention that the larger thing is really, really important, because nothing's going to change until you change the people who are creating all this chaos and white supremacy. But personally, if I'm a teacher and I know that my job is really at risk and I don't know what I can say and what I can't say, I mean, every time now that I go in that classroom, I have to worry in a way I didn't before about the kind of ideas that I'm asking them to just consider, not saying this, you should think this way or that way, that the teachers on this session are really about asking for themselves about ideas that they are now presenting to them. So teachers are very much at risk. So I guess I'm thinking about what we did in the movement, which is that, you know, there has to be some kind of network so that these idiot school boards who are being, you know,
who being taken over by various people. You know, go ahead, Judy. I'll finish.
Okay, yes. By all of the folks that we know are out there, right? What?
You froze for a minute.
I'm sorry. Okay. That Moms for Liberty and Heritage Foundation and all the folks who are, you know, amassed against real education, that there has to be some way that they know, in the way that we did it, that somebody outside that little school board is looking at it. And it can't wait until, you know, the Washington Post or the New York Daily or the New York Times or something does something. I think it really, if there's a way to create something so that, you know, people start flooding that school board in the way that we did. We would contact the Friends of SNCC, and when somebody was arrested, you know, say Mary Lane is in the jail in Greenwood, Mississippi. Well, Mrs., you know, Shaw would call from Chicago, and Mrs. So-and-so would call from... that you have to have some kind of response outside, because they think that they don't have to be beholden to anybody, even in their own community. But at least if somebody outside their community is seeing it and they are aware that they're seeing it, it may help. But I don't know what kind of network you can do to use that. But I would get on the email, I would call, I would do whatever.
Yeah, thank you so much. Now, we just have 2 golden minutes before I want to say some other things, but we have 7 minutes before we're going to wrap up. But this question came from one of our participants. And I want to kind of ask this question too. Like, how can those of us in places like Chicago or here in DC organize to support our colleagues in Texas or Florida or other places where teaching history is being suppressed and criminalized?
I mean, I think you're starting with the Zen Education Project, right? I mean, I'm not sure of all its responsibilities, but I mean, one of the things that Judy just mentioned is having a central location where people can talk about ideas, but also begin to do the kind of supporting and networking that, you know, is really important. I mean, and there are things like might seem that they may be going around and they're not to the point that I have to deal with this problem, but it seems to me there's just a bigger problem that always exists. I mean, one of the things, and I hate to say this at the end so that it may freak people out at least a little more, is that we're really fighting to determine whether public education can exist in this country.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I mean, at the end of the day, that's what the moneyed people want to do, a number of things. So the fight is really a big fight. And it's not just the fight that you have. And it's going to be a fight for a lifetime for those who you believe in education.
Thank you all so much. I think that's a powerful place for us to pause. So I want to say thank you, thank you, thank you.
Thank you for joining us today. This podcast is brought to you by the Zinn Education Project, coordinated by Teaching for Change and Rethinking Schools.
Music provided by The Blue Tide, a Seattle-based acoustic blues duo of Daniel Rapport and JD Lenore, aka Jesse Hagopian. You can find them on Spotify, Apple Music, or wherever you get your music.